You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Michael Litchens. Michael Litchens, editor for Catholic Exchange. Michael Litchens, writer using the English language as his
most
tool.
Most days.
I'm a total monoglot, so it's pathetic how little other languages I know. I know an occasional phrase here and there, and that's kind of it. But Are you a polyglot? Do you know other languages?
I had to learn Latin in school, but I've forgotten most of it. And I do know some Italian. It's not as good as it used to be, but I can still speak it and read it.
Oh, well, that's better than I can do. I learned a jingle from my mother-in-law one time because she went to Catholic school back when you had to learn Latin. And so she taught me Latin is a language dead as it can be. First it killed the Romans, and now it's killing me. So, however, you know, no, learning how to say it in Latin would be even cooler. It probably wouldn't rhyme, though. So I ran across, I've seen various versions of it. I used to know the Latin translation of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which impressively was actually written in the same rhyme scheme as the song, so you can actually sing it with the song. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard? Rudolph is naso rubro, naso ni pisio, sium come nop spectes, dicus eum valjure. Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Nice.
I just ran across another translation of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer into Old English, which I can't pronounce. But it was pretty fun. And then there's like the Old English version of it, and then somebody translated the Old English into modern English. And it's really funny. I don't have it at my fingertips right now, but if you go out and look for if you Google Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer in Old English, you can find it. So that was pretty nifty. So, speaking of Christmas and New Year's, did you have a good one?
I did, all in all. I was sick for a good portion of it, getting whatever plague was going around, but it was really good. You know, got to be a
plague.
Yeah, well, you know, the typical nose cold that turns into a chest cold, and then you know, nothing a little bit of marathoning Battlestar Galactica while on NyQuil won't cure, but maybe that's just me.
Well, you know, it depends on what you mean by a good plague.
It seems like everyone got hit with it at the same time. So
yeah, you know, from the virus's perspective, it was doing the best job it could, you know? And so it was being a good plague. So yeah, this reminds me. I was just gonna say the old Chesterton joke about, you know, we say of a man who can shoot his mother between the eyes at 100 yards that he's a good shot, but not a good man.
Yes.
So, anyway, well, did you, what did Santa bring you? Did you have that?
Yeah, Santa, let's see. Well, mostly this was the first year I actually lived near my family in like 6 years for Christmas. So I didn't have to fly anywhere or miss it because I couldn't afford the plane tickets. So that was a gift in and of itself, just being able to drive across town to go see my parents Christmas, which was a blessing. I forgot how nice that was. And I mostly got what I always want, which is socks and clothes. As a kid, I hated that stuff, but now I love it.
It's, you know, one of the things that, I keep discovering I found a meme somewhere that said, what I really hope to do is, stay in my house, go to bed by 8 o'clock, and have a chance to just sleep and read. He says, the things that were punishments for me as children are now my life goals as an adult.
Yes.
Yes. It's a weird thing, you know. But I'm more or less of a hobbit. I'm going to be going to Reno tomorrow night. No plans to shoot a man just to watch him die.
No, that's too bad.
But, you know, then again, what happens in Reno stays in Reno. So you just never know. But, I'm going to go out there. I'm speaking to a group out there Thursday morning. So, which means, by the way, oh, listeners, that I shall not be on the air on Thursday, for I will be in the air on Thursday. And broadcasting from an airplane is problematic, so can't do that. But we'll have a best of show, and it'll all be great. And I will be back live on Friday with Steve Gradonis. Yesterday, Sherry Antonetti and I talked about the baptism of the Lord. It was the very last day of Christmas yesterday, and now we're back in ordinary time. What do you think of when you hear the phrase, especially as a convert, when you heard the phrase ordinary time for the first time? How did that strike you?
The first time I heard it, I read it in a church bulletin when I was visiting a Catholic church, because it was like the fifth Sunday of ordinary time or something like that. And I was just like, so the way the bulletin had it, it gave the date, which, you know, was like February 11th, 2013 or whatever. Uh-huh. And then, you know, fourth Sunday in ordinary time. And I immediately thought, that is strange. Do the Catholics have a completely different calendar from the rest of the world or what? Yeah. And, you know, I thought maybe they like made up their own months and it's a 380 day calendar. I don't know. And I was just like, who knows what these guys are up to?
Ordinary time. It's one of those phrases that kind of strikes the ear oddly. Mm-hmm. So we're back in ordinary time until whenever Ash Wednesday hits. I'm not sure when Ash Wednesday is this year. Ash Wednesday, of course, is 40 days until I forget. Is it 40 days till Good Friday or 40 days until Easter? I can't remember.
I can't remember all of a sudden, but.
But at any rate, so up until we hit Ash Wednesday, it'll be ordinary time. And then once the Easter season is over, then we get back to ordinary time somewhere around June-ish. And it'll just be ordinary time until Advent starts. Mm-hmm. So it's the big green. I remember, years ago. Pope Benedict gave some homily on the text of Genesis, and it was just the mass reading for whatever was going on that day, but it was ordinary time, and so he gave this typically thoughtful exposition on the book of Genesis and talking about our responsibility for creation. It was sort of a proto Laudato Si homily. Laudato Si is the great encyclical by Pope Francis talking about our care for our common home. So the biblical teaching on creation and our responsibility to take care of creation, because human beings are intimately connected with creation. And if you screw up creation, you're hurting your fellow human beings. Anyway, so Benedict was still Pope at this time. And so he gave some homily on Genesis. And the reporter who was reporting it, I read the story, and noted that Benedict wore green vestments in order to express his solidarity with the environment. Stop! You don't know what you're talking about. Yeah.
He wore green vestments, so for all of you at InfoWars, now you know he's part of the radical environmentalist agenda.
He's part of the radical environmentalist agenda, the green vestments. And you know what? Now priests all over the world are wearing green vestments. It's spread like wildfire through the church. Yeah, yeah. So that was pretty weird. But it's always such a pleasure to watch the faith being reported on in secular media. There's a whole website called Get Religion. It's a terrific website, by the way.
Yes.
And it's a blog by a guy. The guy who runs the blog is a reporter, journalist. He's an Eastern Orthodox, I think. Mm-hmm. And I'm blanking on his name right now.
Terry Mattingly?
That's it, Terry Mattingly.
Mm-hmm.
And the title Get Religion comes from a quote from somebody who was writing about how the media doesn't get religion. It just doesn't know how to report on it, has no idea how to grapple with it, because largely it's written by people who are not themselves believers and so can't grasp the interior contours
mm-hmm.
of various religious traditions. And you see that all the time with that kind of reportage, you know, that's just green. He must be an environmentalist, you know. They've got their frame of reference and they're not going to step outside of it. So anyway, we'll be back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. We're here today with Michael Litchens. We're going to talk a little bit about the wedding at Cana when we return after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Michael Litchens. We're going to be talking a little bit about the wedding at Cana, since that's part of the whole Christmas season that has just concluded, putting us back in ordinary time. But I thought it would be interesting to discuss that particular incident. Recorded only in John's Gospel. John's Gospel is written with the self-conscious awareness of the existence of the other Gospels. So John knows that other Gospels have already been published. They've actually been in circulation by John's time for several decades. And so he's not interested in reinventing the wheel. That story's been told in that way using those stories. And so mostly gonna, with a couple of exceptions, he's gonna ignore that data that's been recorded in those other Gospels because it's already been told. So instead, we're gonna get other stories. Sometimes we'll get repeat performances. So that's what we talked about yesterday, was the story of the baptism of John the Baptist, Jesus' Baptist. But that story is told in different language than we see in the Synoptic Gospels. So it's from John that we hear John the Baptist saying, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world." And John's taking special pains because of his audience. He's taking special pains to drive home to his audience that John the Baptist is not the main event. because there's actually a sect in the area where he's preaching in Ephesus that does in fact regard John the Baptist as the main event. They're called Mandeans. They still exist.
Strangely, yes.
Yeah, they're still around. You know, that's stick-to-itiveness, you know.
Oh my gosh, I know.
And so there's those guys. And so John is writing to his audience, making clear over and over again that John was not the light. He came to bear witness to the light. And he records the story of the Jerusalem delegation showing up to ask John, so are you the Messiah or what? You know, and John saying, no, I'm not the bridegroom, you know, and that right there is significant language. Because when John is talking to the Jerusalem delegation using that language of bridegroom and, you know, friend of the bridegroom and so forth, that whole story is in a particular context, because John has already just told you another story. And that story is just fraught with all kinds of significance for John. So John starts his gospel really consciously drawing our minds back to the book of Genesis. Mm-hmm. So he starts with the same words as the book of Genesis. I remember seeing a cartoon one time of Moses sitting there at a desk with all these wadded up pieces of paper around on the floor. Mm-hmm. And he's like, he's, you know, and he's got several lines crossed out as he's writing Genesis. And so, you know, the first line's crossed out. It's like, it all started with, no, you know. Like, you know, once upon a time, no, you know.
Call me Ishmael. No. No.
So finally he settles on in the beginning. And John very consciously begins his gospel with the exact same words. So Genesis, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So Genesis begins with the start of the universe. What John wants to do is, if you will, take you back to the day before the universe started. That's his beginning. So he's beginning with God himself. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And so he's... That's the cosmic stage that he's setting for us. And he means to then take us into a creation week, just like Genesis does. So if you read the first chapter of Genesis, John carefully, what you see is that John counts off 7 days. So, you know, the first day, John the Baptist went here and said this, and then the next day this happened, and the day after that, you know, Jesus went here and did that, and the day after that, Jesus went here and did that. And so he counts off 4 days, and then suddenly he says, on the third day, Jesus was at a wedding at Cana. And that, as is typical for John, is also freighted with tons of significance. John virtually never says anything that simply has one layer of meaning. He's always speaking at this in this multi-layered way. So on the one hand, you've just counted off, you know, 4 days plus 3 days equals, yes, 7 days, surprise, you know. And at the climax of these 7 days, is something that's intended to remind us of course, the resurrection. It's not just on any day Jesus is at a wedding. It's on the third day, which is in the Christian tradition is a fraught set of words. And what Jesus where we find Jesus is at a wedding, not any place else. And John thinks that that's hugely significant. And he wants us to understand who the bridegroom really is. That doesn't mean Dan Brown is right. That's not John's point is not Jesus is the guy getting married. That's John couldn't care less about that. And in fact, John, like all the other gospels, does not record Jesus having a wife, which itself is odd in that time and place for a man his age not to be married. But what John wants us to get is that whoever that couple is at Cana that's getting married, the real bridegroom is Jesus, and that couple are image, as every married couple is. That couple is a type and a shadow of the relationship between Christ the bridegroom and his bride, the church. And so when Mary speaks to Jesus and says they have no wine, that is, she's not just making conversation about the wine supplies. This is a loaded statement, because the image of wine is an image of the bounty of the Messianic age. This is all over the place in the prophets, that when Messiah comes, you're going to have more wine than you know what to do with. Because wine is this sign of abundance and so forth. And so she says to him, they have no wine. And Jesus's response makes clear that he gets that there's a subtext to what she's saying. You know, because his response isn't, huh, or yeah, you're right. You know, it's very clear that Mary expects that he should be able to do something about this. Otherwise, what's the point of the comment? And Jesus's reply makes very clear that he knows that she's expecting him to do something about this. And that the thing that he's supposed to do about this is going to be hugely significant. That's the only explanation for his reply to her. In Greek, woman, what to me, what to you, is what he says to her. My hour has not yet come. If she's not making some kind of, multi-layered double entendre statement to him, none of his reply to her makes any sense at all. And so, you know, the question is, what is she saying to him? Well, what she's saying to him, of course, is manifest yourself. And who talks that way? Well, this is the way a supplicant talks to God. This is how prayer, oh Lord, would that you would rend the heavens and come down to us, is how the psalmist would put it. You know, come on, let's, you know, it's time, is what she's saying. Show the world who you are. And we will continue this conversation about what happens at the wedding at Cana. Right after this, you're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Michael Litchens, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Michael Litchens. We're talking about the wedding at Cana and that story that's only preserved in John. But John is echoing a theme that you'll find all over the place in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke as well, which is the idea of Jesus as the bridegroom. John doesn't come up with that term. He gets it from both Jesus and John the Baptist. Jesus refers to himself as the bridegroom. You can find that in the Synoptic Gospels. So, you know, the kingdom of heaven is like a wedding feast. He tells the Pharisees, who are miffed at his disciples because they don't fast, and he says, how can they fast when the bridegroom is still with them? Well, he means me. You know, he means himself. He's the bridegroom. And so there's that whole dynamic going on in the Gospels, and it's there in John. So what John wants us to see is not Jesus is getting married to Mary Magdalene in the wedding at Cana. That's not what John is saying. What he's saying is that Jesus, the bridegroom, is the cosmic, heavenly bridegroom. He's the Word made flesh. He's already made that extremely clear. And he's already spoken of himself in ways that, you know, you and I just don't speak of ourselves that way. So,
yeah, that's fair.
If I was standing in the temple courts, my impulse would not be to say, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. Thereby comparing my own body with the holiest place in all of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he was claiming to be God or something, you know? I mean, and so when Jesus is portrayed in the Gospel of John, and we see him at the wedding at Cana, what John wants us to get is that Jesus is the bridegroom. And you can tell that that's what John wants us to get, because if you turn the page in your Bible, there you are with John the Baptist talking to the delegation from Jerusalem saying, I'm not the bridegroom. Jesus, over there in chapter 2, the guy at the wedding at Cana, the one that turned the water into wine, you know, that guy's the bridegroom. And so it's really important to see that, because John will make clear that that miracle, the turning of water into wine, is, he says, the first of Jesus's signs.
Yes.
And his disciples believed in him. And the question then is, what does he mean by the first of Jesus's signs? And the language he's using there isn't primarily meant to denote the first numerically. He doesn't mean this is number one in the seven signs that Jesus is going to do, and we're doing the top seven countdown on, you know, Letterman, and it will culminate with number seven, the raising of Lazarus, you know. So here's the first one. That's not what he means. What he means is this is the archetypal sign. This is the primary sign. This is the sign that will put in context all the other signs that I'm going to record here. So if you want to understand what Jesus is doing here, pay attention to this sign, because it's going to put everything else in context. And in a certain way, it's a bookend between the gospel sort of bookended between this sign and, of course, the great culminating sign of the gospel, what Jesus will in the Synoptic Gospels call the sign of Jonah. In which he is swallowed up by death, as Jonah was swallowed up by the fish, and then raised to life as Jonah comes out of the belly of the fish. We talked about that yesterday. Of all the prophets that Jesus could have identified himself with, the guy he chooses to identify himself with is Jonah. Because baptism is all about drowning and then coming back to life. And so, of course... So what John does is he he shows us Jesus the bridegroom. And Jesus the bridegroom turns water into wine. What's the point of the sign? Well, it's a Eucharistic sign. Of course, it's also a baptismal sign. The water that he turns into wine isn't water in a goblet. It's water in a washing urn, if you will, and big ones. these things were huge. These stone jars. You got a ladle and you dipped down into them because there was no way you were going to lift this enormous stone jar. It was really big, and there's six of these things. And he turns just, it's hundreds of gallons of wine, that he, creates ex nihilo, cause you know, he's God. And, the next thing that you see then after this Eucharistic miracle, cause of course wine reminds us of, the blood of Christ in the Eucharist.
Mm-hmm.
After this, it's John the Baptist, calling Jesus the bridegroom. And then the next thing that happens after that, if you turn the page again, is now you got the bridegroom talking to a woman about marriage. How about that?
Mm-hmm.
And not just any woman, she's a Samaritan woman. And they're not just anywhere. He doesn't meet her, you know, in a marketplace, or just, you know, standing around on a street corner or something, or at a dinner or some other place. He meets her at a well. And so once again, more baptismal imagery. And with that is also the reality that wells have a nuptial significance, in the Old Testament. So, which is not terribly surprising when you think about it, because you're looking at a desert culture. So, of course, you know, sources of water are sources of life, fertility, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Old Testament, you keep running into wells associated with weddings, with marriage. So Abraham sends his servant off to find a wife for Isaac. And the servant stops at a well. And there he meets Rebecca. And he says, you know, God, if it's your will that this, you know, that one of these women here marry my servant or marry my master, Isaac, then if she offers me water, let her offer to water my camels as well. So early, you know, eHarmony marriage arrangements. So she shows up, Rebecca shows up and says, hey, you need a drink? Let me water your camels as well. It's the one. It's the girl. And so there at the well, Isaac's wife is found. Dun, 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 dun. And you know, it keeps happening. Moses, mm-hmm. you know, kills the Egyptian and then lights out of Egypt to get away from Pharaoh and not get rubbed out for murdering the Egyptian. And he stops in Midian, more desert country, and stops at a well. And there he meets Zipporah, his wife. Dun, 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 dun. And so this pattern shows up in the Old Testament. And then this, and now we've got Jesus there at Jacob's well. And he's talking to this Samaritan woman who is the... she's sort of the Elizabeth Taylor of the ancient world, you know. she's had five husbands, and the guy that you're with now is not your husband. And so this is one of those classic multiple layered conversations that John just loves, because he's a literary genius.
Yeah.
And so he takes this, you know, he winds up talking to this this woman. And she's not just any woman. She's a Samaritan woman.
Mm-hmm. It,
we don't know, as modern
sort of suburban Americans, we tend not to know the background of these people. So we know from the text that John says Jews and Samaritans don't like each other. And the apostles have all gone away to get something to eat. And so Jesus strikes up a conversation with this despised Samaritan woman. And despised not only by Jews, but despised by her own people as well, because she's already had five guys, and the guy that she's with now is not her husband. And so Jesus has this conversation with her, but it's important for us to know what a Samaritan is, because it lays out, once you understand this background, it lays out the whole subtext of this conversation. Because just like the conversation with Mary at the wedding at Cana, this is a conversation that is fraught with all kinds of secondary significance. So we'll talk about that when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Michael Litchens. And we'll be back talking about the wedding at Cana right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Hey-o! And welcome. Connecting the Dots. An hour of action-packed theology and fun. Speaking of, with the water being turned into wine and nuptial imagery just busting out all over. So anyway, we were talking before the break. So when Jesus is talking to a Samaritan woman, it's really important to know what a Samaritan is, because it's especially significant in the text itself. And you scratch the surface when you say, you know, that Samaritans were disliked by Jews and Jews were disliked by Samaritans. That's true, but the question then is, well, why? And it's kind of easy for us to sort of go, well, you know, the Middle East, it's always been that way. Everybody hates everybody else in the Middle East because of reasons. But there's actually there's a whole story that goes with the Samaritans. So where do the Samaritans come from? Well, they're the product of what we call today ethnic cleansing. Ethnic cleansing was practiced with tremendous skill in the ancient Near East, especially by conquering empires like the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrians were not nice people. And they were sort of the... If you want to get a sense of the Assyrians, just read the book. I think it's Nahum, one of the minor prophets. One of those prophets that people don't read too much because it's a super short little book. But basically, it's a gloat written by an Israelite prophet gloating about the downfall of the Assyrian Empire. We mentioned Jonah earlier. It's to the Assyrians that Jonah is sent. And it's easy for us to sort of assume that Jonah doesn't want to go to the Assyrians because he's scared. What if they don't listen to me? You know, suppose I get stoned. But if you're assuming any of that, then you haven't read the text of Jonah carefully. The reason that Jonah doesn't want to go see the Assyrians and tell them to repent is not because he's afraid that they won't listen to him. It's because he's afraid they will listen to him. And he really wants the Assyrians to get it in the neck bad. because they were just such horrible people. Their dominant artistic motif is the severed head. So you can find their art is, there's a bas relief of an Assyrian king reclining on his couch with his wife. And if you look around the room carefully, you start realizing that those things that you thought were like fruit hanging mm-hmm. on hooks around the room, those are actually the severed heads of his enemies. And they liked heaping up severed heads.
They were famous for that.
It was a thing for them. And one of the things that they did was they practiced ethnic cleansing with great skill. So what they would do is they would go in and conquer a particular area. And then they would deport everybody that actually lived in the area and import into that area a bunch of other conquered peoples. And put them all together and then say, you guys fight amongst yourselves. One of the continual strategies throughout history is that powerful people will take various powerless peoples and then put them together like spiders in a shaken jar and then say, you guys kill each other and we will just reap the benefits of you guys fighting with each other, because as long as you fight with each other, you can't fight with us. And so we remain on top. And that's what the Assyrians did. So they did this when they conquered the northern kingdom of Israel about 7 centuries before Jesus. They came in, they obliterated the northern kingdom of Israel by deporting most of its citizens to the four winds. That's the 10 lost tribes of Israel. We never hear from them again. And then what the Assyrian did was import 5 different nations into the area that had been the northern kingdom of Israel, as well as a sort of a remnant of, poor, weak Israelites. And then he said, okay, you guys fight amongst yourselves. That was the mm-hmm. program. With these 5 nations that were brought into Israel, you can read about this in the books of the Kings. Each one of these nations had their own cultic fertility deity called a Baal, B-A-A-L. And Baal is an interesting word. It means lord or husband. So what happened was the Assyrians amalgamated with this sort of remnant of Israelites. Not Assyrians, these conquered peoples, amalgamated with the remnant of Israelites, and they did what the Assyrians wanted them to do for a long time, which was fight with each other. But eventually, as happens when people live cheek by jowl long enough, they stopped fighting and started getting married to each other. And when you did that, you married not only your bride and her family, of course, and she your family, but what came into the family tradition was the worship of all these other gods. And so the Jews, the descendants of Judah, living in the southern rump kingdom of Judah, that had remained faithful to the house of David, came more and more to despise this mixed ethnicity group of people in what had been the kingdom of Israel, who worshiped not only the God of Israel, but all these other gods as well, these Baals. So that's why the tension. Mm-hmm. And so when Jesus is talking to this Samaritan woman, there's this whole subtext of this conversation. Because in the language that they're speaking, he says, you've already had 5 Baals, because remember, Baal can mean lord or husband. And the one you're with now is not your husband, your Baal. Who is the one she's with now? I mean, like, right now.
It would sound like Baal.
Well, it's Jesus, of course.
Oh, well, of course, yes.
It's the bridegroom. Mm-hmm. So the bridegroom, once again, shows up proposing marriage. Now, he's obviously not proposing that he wants to get married to this woman. That's not the point, mm-hmm. again. The point, rather, is that this is the bridegroom who is speaking to the woman of Samaria. A nation was...
depicted in feminine terms in the Israelite prophetic tradition. So God speaks of the virgin daughter of Zion, for example. And in the same way, God is now speaking to not merely to this particular woman, but to the woman of Samaria, and again proposing himself as bridegroom. And all of this goes back again to the wedding at Cana. So it's this unfolding of imagery, of this bridegroom imagery, and you'll see it all through the Gospel of John. And so when Jesus is hanging on the cross. And why is he on the cross? Well, he's on the cross because he has ridden into Jerusalem as the son of David, the Messiah. And so the big charge over his head is Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Well, a Davidic king is a king who is husband and father to his people. So when the Israelite elders go to David and ask him to be king over them, they say to him, "We are flesh of your flesh and bone of your bone." Where have you heard that language before in the Israelite tradition?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's, you know, that's nuptial language. It's the language that's used to describe the relationship between Adam and Eve. And so there's Jesus hanging on the cross, and John, in the only time that he does this in his whole gospel, stops the action of his gospel and then steps out sort of in front of the movie screen and says, "I was there. I saw this. You have to believe this." What's the big deal that John saw that it's even more impressive to him than the raising of Lazarus or all the other miracles that Jesus did? It's when Jesus's side is pierced and blood and water flow from his side. Why is that the big deal? Because this is the moment at which the last Adam gives his life for the creation of the new Eve. How was the first Eve made? Made from the side of the first Adam. How is the second Eve made, the bride to the bridegroom? From the side of the second Adam. And so that water and blood that's flowing from the side of Jesus for John, that's not just John going, "Well, I just thought you might be interested in the medical details of pericardial rupture." that's what John sees there is the inauguration of the sacrament of baptism. That water from the side of Christ is baptismal water. And how do you know that, Mark? Well, because John tells us in his first letter, there are three witnesses, the Spirit, the water, and the blood. And these three are one. And so all of this nuptial stuff is going on. And that's why John wants us to pay such close attention to the wedding at Cana. And that's why, along with Christmas and Epiphany and the baptism of the Lord, the wedding at Cana is part of the whole Christmas thing, because it is another way in which Jesus is manifesting himself to the world. Michael Litchens, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer was Danny Head. And I will be back tomorrow with Mr. Rod Bennett. Until then, have a grand evening. Bye-bye.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.